Hello and welcome. This is Your Call. I'm Renee Kemp, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. Nearly a year ago, an estimated 4 million people participated in women's marches across the country, and in fact across the world. It was billed as the largest single-day protest in United States history. That march was a striking visual sign that millions of people not only opposed the policies of the incoming Trump administration, but that they were deeply concerned about the behavior and the character of the new president, a man caught on tape talking about sexually assaulting women, and according to Atlantic Monthly magazine, a man who's been accused by 19 women of sexual misconduct, from groping to rape. Fast forward to October, when reports from the New York Times and the New Yorker magazine revealed disturbing accounts of Hollywood mogul Harvey Weinstein sexually assaulting numerous women. Well, by then the floodgates opened and the hashtag MeToo movement took off. Since then, stories about the misdeeds of men that have long remained secret began to take hold, and the careers of powerful men in Hollywood, media, and politics, those careers began to crumble. These are just some of the major political and cultural events that have shaped this year, 2017, and they coincide with spikes in searches on Merriam-Webster's online dictionary for the word feminism. That made it the online dictionary's word of the year. So what does this year tell us about how far we've come, or maybe not come, to reaching political, economic, and social equality of the sexes? It's a great conversation, and we have three guests who are going to discuss the current state of feminism. She's a product of California Public Schools, and she's proud to say so. Rebecca Solnit is the author of 20 books, including The Mother of All Questions, another title, Men Explain Things to Me, A Field Guide to Getting Lost, as well as three atlases. And Rebecca's here in studio with me. Thank you so much for being here.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
And we're also joined by Andy Zeisler. She's co-founder of Bitch Media and the author of the book We Were Feminists Once, From Riot Girl to Cover Girl, The Buying and Selling of a Political Movement. She's on the line with us from Portland, Oregon. Hi, Andy. Thanks for being here. Welcome back.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You bet. And we are joined by Ijeoma Oluo. She's editor-at-large at The Establishment. It's a media platform run and funded by women. Her book, So You Want to Talk About Race, will be released in January under Seal Press. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Yes, indeed. And we want to invite you early into this conversation. What are your thoughts on feminism in the year 2017? Do you consider yourself a feminist? We want to give you an early start to speak with these guests. 866-798-8255 is our number. Let's start with you, Rebecca Solnit. It appears to me that this is not your mother's feminism. Can you kind of bring us forward? I know that the word goes back to the 1800s, but let's start with that sort of Bella Abzug, Gloria Steinem feminism and talk about the difference between that and this, if you think anything has changed.
I think things have been continuously changing, and I don't love the way we try and bracket it in generations and then pit them against each other. People sure do love to pit women against each other. I think a lot of what's happening right now is happening because of work feminists did earlier. Women are assignment editors. They're TV producers. They're in a position to decide what the story is. They're judges. And so I think that the feminism laid the groundwork for women to be heard, that women are being heard now. And it's a little bit mysterious to me, as these things always are. Why is there a rupture where Black Lives Matter suddenly emerges, even though police killings had always been going on? Why did the Berlin Wall fall in 1989 and not 1987 or 1994? I don't know exactly why this rupture happened, but I'm confident that part of why it happened was that we had a critical mass of women making decisions about what would be heard, of men who had been retaught that women are as credible as men, that we should be heard. So I don't see it as a them and us. I see it as a lot of women who are active in the 60s and 70s are still very active, and some of them are very radical. So,
and maybe this is cyclical. I mean, to what extent do you think that these things come to the surface, we discuss them, we examine them, and then they just go away again until the next cycle?
I don't think they exactly go away. Like Anita Hill, who I think is like the godmother of us all for this kind of stuff, a lot of people will look at it and say, oh, she testified against Clarence Thomas and he's still on the Supreme Court. I do think she struck him dumb because he's barely spoken since then. But the number of sexual harassment in the workplace complaints doubled after her testimony. She made us all aware of the issue. There was some new legislation. And the conversation changes. So it's like we don't get to the promised land in one great leap, but we get a little closer to equity and audibility with each of these things. And the last 5 years have been incredible with a series of horrific things that have happened to women, but that have prompted the conversation to move forward, to force people to look at the pervasiveness of violence against women, whether it's rape, murder, mass shootings, domestic violence, street harassment, workplace harassment and assault. So it's really, you know, these changes are incremental and the conversation dies out. But I think that something remains different, which is not to say it's good enough, but it's different.
Andy Zeisler, what were your thoughts with feminism being chosen word of the year? What are your thoughts on that? Is there anything significant that people seem to be more interested?
Well, It's interesting, and I agree with you know everything Rebecca just said. There's a historical pattern here, which is that feminism, you know, for as long as different feminist movements have been in existence, has largely been defined for the general public not by feminist advocates themselves, but by people who are hostile to the ideology. So actual advocates for feminism have spent a ridiculous amount of time over the years just trying to argue for feminism's validity to begin with. So, you know, much of what contemporary feminism is still involves people saying to feminists, you know, prove to me that this is a valid ideology, prove to me that we need this. And I think because the landscape of media and pop culture has become more democratized and we do have women steering more conversations, we have more actual feminists who are setting the terms of debate and setting the tone of discussion rather than people who are coming from it, coming to it from, you know, a really hostile place.
And Ijeoma Oluo, what is your relationship with the word feminism? I know over time, certainly in the last 50 years perhaps, it's been a fraught discussion about the extent to which African-American women are or have not been a part of the feminist movement. Gloria Steinem was quoted as saying, "I thought black women invented the feminist movement. I've learned feminism disproportionately from black women." So what is your relationship with the word itself?
I have no problem with the word feminism. I do end up oftentimes in conflict with a lot of people who call themselves feminists, because oftentimes people's definition of feminist stops short of black people, other people of color, trans women, disabled women. And I think that, you know, that's a discussion that we're continuing to have, and I think it's very important to have, to continuously push back against those who will define our social justice movements in the image of the majority and the most powerful within those movements.
And Rebecca, I'm wondering, you wrote recently in The Guardian that we're in a moment right now, the hashtag MeToo moment. What is the value in this valley, so to speak?
You mean the hashtags?
Yeah, the whole MeToo movement.
Yeah, I know. It is different than everything else I think we've seen in the last few years where, you know, somebody was exposed for beating his partner or being a serial rapist or there was a mass shooting or something, where we had a great public conversation, often with hashtags, yes, all women, after the Isla Vista massacre in May of 2014, for example. What is different about this one is that it's not one incident. It started with Harvey Weinstein, but something about it, and I sometimes wonder if it's because he committed so many kinds of violent and hostile acts to women, from threats and harassment and non-disclosure agreements silencing them to rape, assault, masturbation, at just all kinds of manipulation. But it's, I don't think we've seen anything like this, where we're seeing, as you said earlier, men in a lot of different fields kind of falling from their standing, powerful men. And I hope this is going on in places where we're not seeing it. If the head janitor is harassing the under janitors, if the cook is harassing the bus girl, the dishwashers. I was a dishwasher who was harassed in the workplace. So part of what feels different is that so many careers have crashed and will continue to crash. And I hope that in that is, you know, we're not going to somehow terminate the career of every man who's done something crummy, because we need to recognize that this is systemic and not, 117 bad guys or 11,047 bad guys. But what I think it does do is give a warning to men that you all got away with this when women were voiceless, when people didn't want to hear it, when we got dismissed. But, that period is over and you can't do this anymore. I don't think we'll be in a free and just society until the desire to violate, abuse, humiliate, disempower, exclude, silence is no longer a desire. And that's a whole other conversation, but it's an exciting moment.
You wrote in the article, too, that feminism has been co-opted both by people who don't understand it and by people who oppose it. Worse, it's now being used against people who are feminists and their allies. What do you mean it's been co-opted?
Well, we've had a number of incidents. Yesterday, somebody put up posters attacking Meryl Streep as though she somehow was personally responsible for Harvey Weinstein. She said she hasn't known. But also we saw, we still don't understand, why did InfoWars and Roger Stone, who's been an attack dog for the far right since the Nixon era, why did they have advance notice that Leanne Tweeden was going to Al Franken? And then Mike Cernovich got NBC News to fire Sam Sater. Sater had actually tweeted in 2009, I think, making fun of the defenders of Roman Polanski. So his tweet was a rape joke, but it was a rape joke making fun of rape excusers, rape justifiers. And so you're seeing these people who clearly don't give a damn about feminism using this idea that, oh, we'll out men who did bad things to target men and essentially weaken the liberal to left zone, and while also defending the right. And we also heard lots of stuff from Sean Hannity about Franken and other liberal men, and Hannity, who's had nothing to say about Donald Trump, Bill O'Reilly, Roger Ailes, and some of the other powerful abusers associated with Fox News. And so we can see that how easy it is for this stuff to get misused. And in it, I think, is also a question of, well, who should be in charge of this? Because you're also seeing men, just like the men being deposed, very powerful men in their industries, making the calls. And I think what this also calls for is a big question of who should be in charge? Because when these people were in charge, it didn't turn out so well.
Ijeoma Oluo, you've wrote about this as well, both in The Guardian, in The Establishment and in USA Today. What is your thinking about this hashtag MeToo moment?
Oh, I did not write about USA Today. I actually wrote about an interaction I had with USA Today that was quite disturbing in the way in which this moment has been, people are trying to manipulate this moment. I have some hope for this moment. I do hope that we can keep it going. I hope that we can turn it into more than a moment and turn it into a movement, because I think that time and time again we ask victims of gendered violence, sexualized violence, to pour their hearts out and relive all of their pain in the hopes that we will see what a huge systemic issue this is. And time again we kind of fail to sustain that. And I hope we actually can this time make some real systemic change and really look at it. I am hopeful in seeing more discussions around this systems that are making such rampant abuse possible, and I hope that we can keep that up and build some real accountability in. But I do think it's really early to start looking at this as sort of like monumental change, because that's definitely something that's going to be years before we're able to tell if we have put enough in place to make real lasting change in how women and femmes are treated in the workplace and in the public spheres and in the social sphere.
We want to invite our listeners. What are your thoughts on feminism in 2017? What do you think about how far we've come or haven't come, perhaps, in reaching equality of the sexes? Is this a watershed moment this year? Do you consider yourself a feminist? And what does the term even mean to you? Give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can drop us an email at yourcall@kalw.org or post a web comment at yourcallradio.org. Andy Zeisler, because we're talking about a specific moment in time, I think we'd be remiss not to look at some of the other cultural influences that have been part of 2017, starting with the D.C. March, of course, the charges of sexual improprieties. But apparently, Merriam-Webster reports that they had a spike in lookups of the word feminism after Hulu aired The Handmaid's Tale, the Margaret Atwood story. And after the Wonder Woman film came out, all of a sudden it spiked again because Gal Gadot was portrayed as a powerful, beautiful woman, and that those two things didn't cancel each other out. What are your thoughts on the impact of popular culture on the movement in general?
Well, I think it's been, you know, it's made a really indelible mark, and it's a really important one. When, you know, I trace a lot of the sort of current contemporary feminism as a trend to Beyoncé performing at the 2014 MTV Video Music Awards with the word feminist in, you know, giant letters behind her. And as someone who grew up in the 80s when no one wanted to align themselves with that word, that Beyoncé moment was incredibly important just in terms of optics. You know, when you consider how many millions of people were watching that, and in particular young people, and realizing that their first exposure to the word feminist or the concept of feminism, it comes in the, you know, in the person of Beyoncé, one of the biggest, you know, pop stars in the world. That's really important. That's incredibly important because, again, like, when you let other people define the terms of the debate, it really shuts off a lot of possibilities. And so I do think that, that, you know, the pop culture embrace of feminism, it's certainly a mixed bag. But in terms of that kind of gateway function, it's definitely there. You know, if people come to the idea of feminism through Beyoncé, through Gal Gadot, through The Handmaid's Tale, that's really important. And it's really not that different from, you know, me coming to feminism through, you know, I don't know, young adult books in the 80s or, you know, feminist books that somehow wound up in my hands. I think we all sort of need that gateway. That said, I think the context, feminism has been used in so many contexts in the past couple of years that it's really hard to know where people are coming to it. You know what I mean? We have fashion magazines saying that, you know, a $700 Christian Dior t-shirt is a feminist statement. Or, you know, you've got, people talking about things that are, you know, inanimate objects as feminist, like this perfume is feminist, this, you know, these running shoes are feminist. So I think there's a lot of confusion about the difference between feminism as something that you can sort of consume in the marketplace and feminism as, you know, an ongoing living movement that that needs constant attention to sustain it.
So do you think that pop culture is following or leading?
I think it's both. I mean, pop culture and feminism have always had a symbiotic relationship. They absolutely inform each other, and each one of them, you know, brings new people to the movement, to understanding it, to wanting to know more about it. And so, you know, on the one hand, I do think it's really important to have a range of entry points for people to be curious about feminism, and we have to meet people where they're at. You know, not everyone is going to come to feminism through, you know, a college class or through, you know, reading actual feminist theory. And, you know, the ideal is that people who come to it through media and pop culture will be able to sustain that interest in other ways.
You know, I was reading, rereading, actually, the book Lean In, and Ijeoma Oluo, you have written extensively about feminism for a long time and its complicated history, but in rereading Lean In, it occurred to me that the basic philosophy was you have not because you demand not, and you simply have to lean in and demand more. But I'm wondering, having read it now for a second time, if that doesn't kind of ignore the systemic problems that are there no matter how much you lean in. Can you weigh in on that?
Yes, definitely. I read that when it first came out, and I was working in the corporate environment at the time, and everyone was saying, oh my goodness, you have to read this book. And I read it, and I was just like, this is the easiest way for me to get fired from my job. Especially as a, you know, 6-foot-tall black woman, leaning in does not work for me. I can't even slightly raise my voice without being seen as violent and overly aggressive. And I think that that book was oftentimes what's called in social media circles as white feminism. And I think even before we really were talking about white feminism all the time, that was a classic example of kind of acting as if privilege was part of the work done. You know, the privilege of having an audience, the privilege of being able to state your demands, the privilege of being in the room was part of the work done. And it seemed to almost blame other people who didn't have that privilege to be able to go up and demand these sorts of things and know that they would have a job or to have a nanny. And all of these things were written about in the book. I was reading it and just going, wow, this is a nice life if you can get it. I think that acting as if that's part of the work you did instead of part of what was bestowed upon you, and also in many ways part of the problem, is where oftentimes, you know, we run into issues and we need to kind of examine our feminism more deeply, because it's often defined by those who already have the most privilege within a group and already have the most power. And it can turn into a kind of a victim-blaming thing where people are kind of defining it from, you know, two feet away from the goalpost and saying, why aren't you here with me? If you just tried harder, you'd be here with me. But that's the same thing that men have been saying to women for a very long time, and it's simply not true.
Rebecca Solnit, do you have thoughts on the schism that has, real or imagined, existed among women of color who are feminists and white women who are feminists?
Yeah, again, I'm a person who always likes the most complicated narrative possible, so, you know, there are great moments of solidarity from the birth of the feminism in the United States in the abolitionist movement and the kind of wonderful overlap between Frederick Douglass and the early suffragist feminists. And then, of course, some of them fail profoundly in that they don't support the move to get black men the right to vote and say racist things. And I think you can find it both ways. But I think absolutely Sheryl Sandberg is such a good example of somebody who doesn't get structural inequality and the need for systemic change. And the lean in thing, what came to mind for me is 75% of women who report workplace sexual harassment are punished one way or another for, or there's retaliation against them. This whole idea that you're just not doing it right is like, you know, women are constantly caught in double binds where, you know, you get sexually harassed and that sucks. And if you speak up about it, you'll get punished for it and that sucks. And if you just leave your job, you'll be unemployed and maybe you'll become homeless or your kids will starve. And, you know, there's a lot of situations where women don't have good choices under the present system, which is why we need analysis of where racism and structural inequality and economic inequality really matter in this. You know, the idea that we can just solve problems individually is basically a right-wing idea that says the system is fine, just try harder. There's a bumper sticker I've always wanted to make. It says, from their mountaintops, they see the playing fields are level. And that applies to people like Sheryl Sandberg.
You know, one of my favorite quotes is from Shirley Chisholm, and she says, the emotional, sexual, and psychological stereotyping of females begins when the doctor says it's a girl. We're talking today with three folks who are weighing in on the state of feminism in 2017. This is Your Call. We're speaking with Ijeoma Oluwo, and she's the editor-at-large at The Establishment and author of the forthcoming book, So You Want to Talk About Race. Also joining us today, Rebecca Solnit, author of 20 books, including Men Explain Things to Me. And also here with us is Andy Zeisler, co-founder of Bitch Media, author of the book, We Were Feminists Once. Hope you'll stay with us. We'll be right back after a short break. Welcome back. For those of you just joining us, I'm Renee Kemp, sitting in for Rose Aguilar today. This is Your Call. We are podcasting our show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org, and there you can also listen to past shows and find out what's coming up next. If you have a show idea for us, please drop us a line at yourcall@kalw.org or give us a call, 866-798-8255. Coming up tomorrow, we're talking to UCSF physician and author Robert Lustig. He has a new book called The Hacking of the American Mind. Today, we're talking feminism, and we'd love to have you join the conversation. What are your thoughts on feminism in 2017? Do you consider yourself a feminist? Give us a call, 866-798-8255. Rebecca Solnit, can you talk about the structural issues that still stand in the way of the idea of feminism? Has been around for generations now, and we can see that there are some, as you said, women are in charge. They are managing editors. They get to make decisions about what stories get covered. They get to hire and fire. But what structural impediments still exist?
You know, when I said that earlier, it's like we have more women in power than we ever have before, but there's still not, we sure don't have parity in any industry that I know of. And you can look at Congress, for example, where I think that this U.S. Senate is 80% white and 80% male, or more than 80% male, you know. And one thing is child care, and which falls disproportionately on women, and handicaps women from having equal time and energy to, in professional spheres to compete. I think another thing is, you know, these things are hereditary. White people have a lot more money than black people, and then they pass it on to their kids. We look at the way that just the basic economic system, has always been set up so that black people haven't caught up with white people in wealth. We can look at just a lot of different ways. And when men run the system, they tend to hire men, they tend to promote men. And there's so many studies about how men and women get reviewed differently, what's leadership in a man, is bossiness in a woman, women get interrupted. There was a great thing I quoted in one of my Harper's columns about how women Supreme Court justices, because even when you're on the Supreme Court, you get women justices get interrupted more than men. And that's not just kind of an annoyance, because these things are often written out off as just, well, that's sort of unpleasant, but whatever. It actually prevents them from being able to frame the argument, get their ideas across, etc. So we have a host of things, from what we called a few years ago microaggressions to the entire economic structure that privileges whiteness, privileges maleness, privileges a bunch of things that that you can sum up as the status quo, and changing that is the challenge.
Andy Zeisler, you refer to something that you call feminism's uncanny valley. I think I referred earlier to whether or not you find that, when I was asking Rebecca, is there any value in the valley in which we find ourselves? And you use that same term. So what do you mean by feminism's uncanny valley?
Well, the term uncanny valley has to do with robotics, and it's the idea that, we react favorably to, artificial intelligence or robots or facsimiles to a certain point, and then at the point where they become sort of creepily, uncannily familiar is when we turn against them. And I think what you all were talking about regarding Sheryl Sandberg, for instance, is a really good example of feminism's uncanny valley, where you see an entire sort of media going wild for this idea of this new kind of empowerment, this lean-in empowerment. But then you have, you know, feminist advocates on the outside saying, no, this is not real. It reads as feminism to a critical mass of people, but it's the same old patriarchy, you know, with a slightly friendlier makeover. So I think one of the things about the uncanny valley has to do with the fact that, you know, legal decisions and office protocol and things like that don't necessarily change people's minds, and that's a big hurdle. Like, you can have the recourse in the office to, you know, complain to HR about sexual harassment, or, you know, you have the networking groups telling you this is how to negotiate for a raise, but that doesn't change people's minds. And so feminists kind of get stuck in that valley of sort of performing feminism and looking from the outside as though they are, you know, really making strides, but are, you know, as Rebecca said, are in this place where studies show that when women ask for more money, they're more likely to get turned down, or when women act as if they are men in the workplace, they are penalized for it.
What does that mean, act as if they're men in the workplace?
Well, there was an article that came out a few years ago in The Atlantic, I think, that was about, you know, the confidence gap, and it was about closing the confidence gap. And it was sort of like, you know, what happens when women act in the office with the kind of casual, you know, sort of chumminess and clubbiness that men have enjoyed for decades? Like, what happens when a woman tries, for instance, just like popping by her boss's office? And maybe a man could do that, and it would be, you know, fine. They talk about golf, whatever. Mm. But when a woman does it, you know, she's perceived as overly ambitious or bossy or inappropriate. So we have these places where, you know, we really want to believe as a society that we have really come a long way, but we are still held back by a lot of stereotypes, a lot of perceptions, and a lot of really deep-seated beliefs about what is, you know, what women do and what men do.
Let's go to a phone call. It's Ruby in Mill Valley. Hi, Ruby.
Hi, good morning. Love the conversation. As you have just been speaking, I was wondering, I have a question about Helen Curley Brown, the editor of Cosmopolitan magazine and the Cosmo Girl concept, if you all remember that. I don't know how old you all are. But it was, the philosophy was sleep your way to the top. And this was sort of foisted upon women to do that. And her great success was her doing that as she proceeded to become a very high-ranking woman. My original question is about Al Franken and the others who don't seem to have done something so awful. I am just shocked at my female friends who say, as I have zero tolerance for it. I just have zero tolerance for it. But they say, oh, yeah, but you know, there's a different level of things, and he should stay in the Senate because it wasn't as bad as the other stuff. It wasn't exposure and a masturbation. And I'm like, no, zero tolerance is zero tolerance.
Those are both really good questions. Thanks a lot, Ruby. Let's take the second one first. E.G.L. Maulowo, you wrote about Al Franken. Do you want to take this one on? Why are we making the distinctions in behaviors?
Yeah, I think that, honestly, in this distinction is some of the most important work in dismantling rape culture in our society, is that we have to attack where we are willing to kind of sacrifice our morals for convenience. And that's really what it is. I was a huge Al Franken fan. I literally cried over this entire thing. I have all of his books. I have pictures of him. But the truth is that we have made bad deals. We have allowed really bad things to happen because the men doing them are men that we like or men that we depend on, you know, men that we have formed relationships with. And this is what it's going to look like as we dismantle these systems. It is not going to be all monsters who are, you know, violating the rights of women and abusing women because this is so systemic. It is going to be people you love, people you admire. And there do need to be consequences while we also address the entire system. And that's part of the problem is that there hasn't been. If there had been consequences in the past, if we had treated the sexual harassment and the sexual abuse of women as seriously as we should have as a society, this is not something Al Franken would have dreamed of doing. You know, he's a very intelligent person. And what he did, being who he is, shows how endemic this is. And it is disturbing to me, too. I think that what we're going to look back on this and see so many feminists willing to quickly offer up their ideals in trade and say, oh, it's not that bad, when they never dream of saying that in any other situation, is going to be another moment where we had a chance to kind of stand up for what we believe in and really start fresh and start making better deals and saying, no, we are not negotiating away the humanity of women in any situation. And many of us are going to look back and say that we kind of failed that. But I think that if we investigate it now and at it now, we can move forward and start making better choices. And I think it's really important starting with this, because if we want to change this culture, that means that we're going to have tough conversations and have tough consequences for people that we love. And it's not going to just hurt them. It's going to hurt us as well, because you know we've made deals with them. We depend on these people.
And Rebecca, I'm wondering what your thoughts are, because there are folks who say should there not be a gradation of treatment of behaviors? Is it the same when an elder George H.W. Bush in a wheelchair and infirm grabs the behind of a young woman that's taking a picture with him, and say, for example, someone who grabs a woman and then manages to get elected president after bragging about it? Is there nothing in between, or, you know, can we afford to treat all of them the same?
You know, I think that we have all this language around it, like zero tolerance, but what does that mean? And we do have a criminal justice system that, you know, and sort of rules in workplaces and things like that that do treat things as, you know, misdemeanors and felonies and et cetera. And, but I also think that one of the real dangers in the way all this is operating is the pretense that that we're going to isolate individual men and that it's we remember from the George Bush era that term, a few bad apples. They're trying to pretend that the people who engage in torture in Abu Ghraib, in Iraq, were a few bad apples. But in fact, the whole system was invested in supporting and countenancing torture. And the entire system has been permitting this to go on because it's so pervasive. And I think if you look at the level of what Al Franken's been charged with, probably most heterosexual men in elected office in Washington are guilty of the same things. And, you know, I do have questions about the InfoWars and Roger Stone advanced knowledge of Tweeden's complaints and her affiliation with Fox and Hannity and et cetera, raise questions. I hope somebody's doing good investigative journalism about it. I would have liked to see an investigation. I would have liked to know more about it all. But I want us to talk about the whole system and changing the whole system.
So it's not about rotten apples. It might be the barrel that's the problem.
It might be that all the apples are poison apples and we need to stop having those apples and, you know. And
I don't know how far we want to take that analogy.
I know, but the metaphor gets very fruity.
Right.
But I just think that there is a way that I think the people in charge want to pretend we're going to out a finite number of men and then and punish them and then pretend that everything's fine. And it's like, no, the entire system is rotten, and the system is called patriarchy or white supremacist patriarchy, and we need to transform it, which means changing who's in charge, changing who decides, changing who gets heard, et cetera, because that's why these things happen in the first place. It is systemic. I have a friend who worked in Congress in the 90s. He says basically the congressmen are about 100% guilty. And we're not really talking about that this is normal and this is pervasive. I think some of these men are rushing around. You know, it's like the Charlie Chaplin movie where the thief goes around the corner and joins the crowd chasing the thief so that he looks like he's on the the other side. And they're covering them, you know.
Well, in many ways, it's a watershed moment because of that.
Yeah.
Because they feel the need to run. And Andy Zeisler, I wanted to ask you about the other half, briefly, of Ruby's question, which was, what about that whole part of popular culture that started with, say, Cosmopolitan, that encouraged women to use their sexuality to get where they want it? Helen Gurley Brown says, I did it, you can too. How do you speak to that?
Well, Helen Gurley Brown was in many ways sort of play acting as the Cosmo girl because, you know, once she started Cosmopolitan, she was sort of very well settled. And I think this is one of those sort of Stockholm syndrome parts of women's history where we're, you know, told that we have a limited amount of power, that it comes from our sexuality and our desirability, and that we should use that because that's the best tool we have. And obviously that has been successful for a lot of women, but that doesn't mean it's the only tool we have. That doesn't mean it's the one that we should use at the expense of the others. You know, again, as Rebecca said, there has been a systemic investment in patriarchy in part because there's absolutely no incentive for people in power to give up that power and give up that privilege. So, you know, when we talk about the fact that these things seem cyclical and these things seem to, you know, resurge all the time, it's because it's a constant battle to get particularly white men to even recognize that they hold this power, much less loosen their grip on it. So I think over the years, powerful women who have made strides into that sort of rarefied space historically reserved for men have their own reasons for sort of pulling the ladder up behind them. And Helen Gurley Brown was, you know, doing what she felt was beneficial for women given what they had, given the fact that, you know, she was very canny about what the capitalist patriarchy does and does not approve of in women.
And I think we have a caller who would love to kind of weigh in on this. It's Edwin in Richmond. Hi, Edwin. Thanks for holding on. Can you turn your radio down, please?
Yeah, radio's down. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you for having me on. I have a simple question. Given Weinstein in 2017 and their influence on media with Miramax and everything, would you guys tend to agree with me that that it would actually be a good idea for feminists to try to stop or at least slow down on having so many naked women on TV and movies?
Well, let's see. Let's tee that up for Ijeoma. Okay, Ijeoma Oluo, what do you think about Edwin's question about it being counterproductive to have provocative images of women while at the same time telling men that you can't look at women as sexual objects? I think that's what Edwin was saying.
I think that women can be sexy and can have their own sexuality, and in no way does that mean that men are entitled to them. And I think that we have to be able to separate the two, and I think it's incredibly important that we always protect women's ability to present themselves however they wish, because it is their bodies. Bodily autonomy, you know, means that we do what we want with our bodies, and it means that we don't do things for men, but also do things just in reaction to men as well. I don't think that my definition of freedom means that I hide my body so that men aren't looking at it, just as much as it doesn't mean that I flaunt my body so men will look at it. My definition of freedom means I do what I want with my body, and it's still mine. Men take their shirts off all of the time and don't walk around you know, feeling unsafe and feeling like women are going to suddenly claim ownership over their bodies. And I think that it is incredibly important that we protect both of those things, because there will always be a reason why men feel that they can do what they want with women and femmes. And we cannot entertain any of those reasons. And if we say it's, you know, okay, we're going to dress more modestly, or we're not going to do these sexy shoots, we're not going to do these things, then there will be, you know, where we failed that definition, or maybe there will be another reason why. We cannot entertain any of that. It has to be a hard and fast rule that women's bodies are their bodies, and you do not have access to them without enthusiastic consent. And that stands no matter what we're wearing, no matter what we're doing. They're ours. You know, and so I think this debate as to, you know, well, what about if you're wearing this? The truth is that women should be able to walk down the street in whatever they want, and people should keep their hands to themselves, and people should still treat them as human beings worthy of respect.
Andy Zeisler, I'd love to have you weigh in. Anyone who's co-founded an organization called Bitch Media, I'd love to hear your thoughts on how males portray women when they have the opportunity to green light a film, for example, or they're the ones who determine commercial content. Have you determined in looking at this issue whether, given power to make those decisions, that a female would be making different decisions?
Yes, and we know a lot about Hollywood. One of the really great things about social media over the past decade is that things, knowledge that was previously, you know, sort of buried within the industry has become public knowledge. We see reports we see studies being disseminated about, you know, how many women work behind the scenes, how many, you know, the minutes of speaking time that lead female characters have in a feature film as opposed to male. So we have a lot more knowledge about that. We know that, for instance, women who direct independent films that are hits at Sundance are almost, they're not at all likely to get a feature film directing job after that. But men, especially white men, disproportionately are. So that you have, you know, guys who have directed one small indie suddenly being handed, you know, a superhero franchise. So we have that information. So we understand the way in which funding in particular is really critical for getting women's voices out there. And we know that that so much of how women are cast, even in roles that, you know, don't call for overt sexuality, we know that that's based on sexuality, and certainly that's being, you know, corroborated in great volume by the women who are coming forward in this Me Too moment. So, you know, we are aware that given the chance, women's creative projects, especially in movies, look different. You know, we see that with Patty Jenkins' Wonder Woman movie as opposed to whoever's, you know, Avenger movie. We see that with Ava DuVernay's work. We see a world through women's eyes that, you know, looks very different from what we have historically seen, and a lot of people are a little put off by it, and they feel that, you know, oh no, the women's lens is taking over. And my feeling is sort of like, well, yeah, I mean, and it's about time. And also, I think people tend to overestimate when women's participation is showcased. People tend to feel like, oh no, does this mean there won't be any, you know, directing jobs for men? Oh no, what about the men? And another thing we know is that women's participation, there's sort of a numerical fallacy where, you know, if women are 30% of the people in a room, for instance, the men in that room will perceive that it's 50-50. And if there's more than 30% of women in that room, men will perceive themselves as, you know, outnumbered. So I think that's a lot of the effect that we're seeing with sort of more high-profile female directors and showrunners.
Okay, Andy Zeisler. I'm going to ask each person that we've been talking to today to take about 30 seconds and just tell me what issues you'd like to see revived and given priority if, in fact, what we're seeing is a revival of a feminist movement. Rebecca Solnit, can we start with you? About 30 seconds.
Yeah, and thank you. An honor to be here with those other speakers. I think something that we need to talk about and have been talking about in this round is what's not what's present, but what's absent. What women didn't get to tell their stories? Who left their careers? Whose stories didn't get told? Whose voices didn't get heard? And for me, that connects very much to something I've also been passionate about this year, which is voter suppression. That just as women have been left out of who writes the news stories, who slants the news, who writes the entertainment stories, so the 20 million people who weren't allowed to vote were left out of who determines not just who won the election, but who our candidates are and what the issues are.
Ijeoma Oluo.
Yeah, I would love to look, you know, I hope that we can continue to focus on systemic accountability. A lot of times when we talk about these social issues, what happens is there's this very quiet backlash we don't see where those in power try to shore up the systems that actually keep the patriarchy and rape culture and these dangerous systems in place. And I really do think that we need to hyper-focus on not only voting laws, but also, you know, things like our statutes of limitations on reporting rape and sexual assault around the country, which are incredibly egregious in many states and prevent people from ever getting justice and from getting violent predators off of the streets. We need to look at labor laws. We need to look at pay gaps. We need to look at government representation. We need to look at media representation. We need to start looking at who's in our labor meetings, you know, who's in our management meetings. We need to start looking at, you know, our practices and our business
Ijeoma,
and our education.
Thank you so much. Thank you to all of our listeners today and to our guests. Thank you all for joining us. I'm Renee Kemp, and this is Your Call.